sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Cohen and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Niles Goldstein, author of the books Gonzo Judaism and the new book, Eight Questions of Faith, Biblical Challenges That Guide and Ground Our Lives. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Cohen and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We began the new Hebrew calendar month of Elul last Sunday, final month of the Jewish year, which means we are about to begin the yearly journey of the fall holiday season. 3 weeks from tonight, Rosh Hashanah begins, the Jewish New Year. In this season, we examine the choices we make and the ways they have worked out for us in the past year. It's a great time of year, but a serious one. The month of Elul, this final month, is bracketed by Torah portions taken from the book of Deuteronomy that are famously about choice. At the beginning, Moses says to the people of Israel, "See, I set before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you follow God's commandments, the curse if you don't obey or listen." This looks like a simple restatement of the central message repeated all the way through the book of Deuteronomy. Do mitzvot, do commanded acts and get goodies, commit sins and get punished, do good, be blessed, do evil, get cursed. But a modern Torah commentator, Nachama Leibowitz, noted that these are not really two parallel ifs. Blessing if you listen to God, curse if you do not. The Torah, in fact, uses two different Hebrew words. A better translation would be the blessing because you listen, the curse if you do not. So the blessing of God is definite, but the curse is only a possibility. You will be blessed when you follow God's commandments, the Torah says. You might be cursed if you violate them. According to Jewish tradition, this means that God actually gives us a line of credit, an ethical equity loan, if you will, and we can borrow blessings on the speculation that we will likely do mitzvot. It seems like a good deal for us, not necessarily for God. God gives us a blessing cushion, a kind of allowance we get to use up in the hope that we will pay it back, not even pay it forward through our actions. This is a comforting thought. We get blessings on the hope that we will do good acts. God rewards us and then hopes, prays, that we act well. I really like this image of God. It says that God wants us to succeed and cares enough about us to loan us a little goodness in advance to help our cause. Our sole responsibility is to learn to be good, to continue to choose the right course so that we will merit the blessings we've already received. As we approach the coming season of repentance, the time of return in Jewish tradition, the Torah urges us to hope that God will always give us the benefit of doubt. And it is, in fact, extending us credit in advance to help us with our return to our best selves. All we must do is take advantage of this rare opportunity. One lesson of this blessing loan is that we ought to feel gratitude for the latitude that God gives us. If we remember to feel grateful for the gifts we've received from God, we'll have the opportunity to act from those feelings of thanksgiving for what we already have. All God asks is that we return to following ethical ways, the ones the commandments, the mitzvot, outline for us, and seek to live as well as we possibly can. When we do that, we are at least theoretically repaying some of the many goodnesses we have already received. And if we can manage that, then each of our lives may indeed be filled with the blessings that God will continue to freely give us in the coming year. 5776. To play us in on this second Sunday in Elul, here's the Metropolitan Opera tenor and cantor Jan Pierce singing the classic High Holy Day prayer, Avinu Malkeinu, to Max Chernofsky's famous setting.
O vino malcheno, chamolo leno, veio allo leno, veta peno.
That was cantor and operatic tenor Jan Pierce singing the classic prayer of the High Holy Day season, Avinu Malkeinu. Rabbi Niles Goldstein has had a varied and fascinating career as a rabbi, ranging from creating a congregation in Manhattan to writing a series of interesting books seeking Jewish inspiration on an adventurous path, which has included a black belt in the martial arts, a midlife crisis, and a thoroughly unconventional rabbinic journey. His new book explores those kinds of issues through biblical figures. Find out about his latest venture when we come back with Rabbi Niles Goldstein in a few moments, right here on Too Jewish.
Everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's famous Taste of Judaism program, now in its 16th year, offers an exploration of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community, taught by our rabbis. Call 327-4501 for more information and to register today. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity to learn about Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. The classes are free and open to all, and we feed you too. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year in Suarita as well. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, the whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class. And we're thrilled to offer American Sign Language Interpretation, ASL, for one of the sessions. Remember, there are no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email mila@templeemmanueltucson.org. That's Taste of Judaism, 520-327-4501. A fun way to learn about Judaism. Don't miss it.
We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Niles Goldstein is one of the, most interesting rabbis of my generation. An author, he's created kind of a unique rabbinate of his own, including a fascinating book, Gonzo Judaism, which won a number of awards. He has a new book out with Jewish Publication Society, 8 Questions of Faith, Biblical Challenges that Guide and Ground Our Lives. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning to you, Sam. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit. You really have, I would say, a rabbinate that you've chosen, unlike most of the rest of us who have kind of wandered through our careers looking for the next step or trying to figure it all out. Tell us a little bit about your path.
Well, it's been an interesting and a colorful one, and I appreciate your kind words. You know, I would have to say, now that I'm in the thick of middle age, I'm 49, there's been a part one and a part two. So trust me, I've been wandering through a bit of the wilderness myself these last few years. But I would say, you know, in my first few years, and I graduated rabbinical school in New York City, I tried to forge a rabbinate that was pretty entrepreneurial. I knew that writing was very important to me, both in terms of the kinds of books that I've written, spirituality, personal growth, religion, as well as secular writing, you know, poetry, a short novel, things I had done before I even contemplated becoming a rabbi. So the first few years out of graduate school, I tried to take jobs that gave me enough time to focus on my writing as well. I worked at a foundation for a couple of years. I worked at a think tank called CLAL. I even served as an assistant rabbi at a large Reform synagogue in Westchester County. So my first few years out of rabbinical school were pretty eclectic. It gave me a lot of time to develop my career as an author and a speaker and scholar in residence. And then, completely out of the blue, although it was something I had always really wanted to do, I wound up becoming the founding rabbi of a progressive, pluralistic synagogue in Greenwich Village in Manhattan. And I was there for over a decade before I came back to Chicago a few years ago. So it's been very interesting. You know, I've always been focused on pluralism in my rabbinate. I've always done a lot of interfaith work. But I've always tried to also focus on my writing and teaching. And, you know, that's meant that I haven't gone in a conventional direction like so many of our colleagues. And, you know, that has presented some challenges, especially as I get older and want a little bit more stability. But I don't think I would do anything any differently if I had a chance.
So I promise we'll get to talk about your new book when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish with Rabbi Niles Goldstein. We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. You know, we have more than 14 months to go until the election for president of these United States, but it's better to be early than late. We continue, then, with our special election year or so feature, the 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report, in-depth coverage, unusual features, and the finest opinion on the air as we choose the new leader for our nation. The nuclear deal with Iran, negotiated by President Obama on behalf of the U.S. and the group of entities known as the 5+1, Britain, France, Russia, China, and Germany, has been in the news nonstop since the agreement was announced July 14th. All the U.S. presidential candidates for 2016 have a position on it, and it's pretty simple. The Democrats all support it, the Republicans all oppose it. Their reasoning may vary a little. The vehemence of the supporter opposition may differ in tone or color, but that's the formula. Every Republican candidate from Donald Trump to Ben Carson to Carly Fiorina to John Kasich to Rand Paul and so on has said that he or she will revoke the deal if elected president. All the Democratic candidates, even potential ones like Joe Biden, all of them support it and say it will stay law if they are elected president. Draw your own conclusions. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, our Shlicha, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So we are now fully into the period of beginning to prepare for the Jewish High Holy Days in the month of Elul. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are coming up. This is a time that's called Slichot, the time when we do prayers of apology. Not everybody really understands this custom. Some people think Slichot is just the Saturday night before Rosh Hashanah, which is an Ashkenazi custom, but in Israel it's much more than that, and particularly in Sephardic and Edot HaMizrach Eastern communities. Let's talk about Slichot a little bit.
Yeah, I'm from Mizrahi descent. That's how you say, right?
Yeah, Mizrahi.
So it's 40
right.
days. It's from Rosh Chodesh of Elul, from the beginning of Elul till Yom Kippur. And the month of Elul, it's also a few days are still in the Chofesh, like the...
Still vacation
vacation
yeah.
from
summer
school.
Vacation.
Yeah,
right.
So as a kid, we remember that all the grandchildren would come to my grandfather and grandmother's house because they share a wall with the synagogue.
Right.
So that's my grandfather used to go. So as a kid, we will have like, you know, 3 a.m., my grandma will prepare right. a nice tea for us with mint and cookies, and we will sit next to the door, next to the wall.
And listen to the Slichot prayers coming at 3
listen,
in the morning.
Because it was, right. you know, too early. But then as soon as the sun will go up, we'll go out and join our Sabbath. So it's a beautiful time of year for me to remember.
It really sounds fantastic. Slichot is... after all, a time when you're supposed to get up in the middle of the night. You know, in other words, you go to bed, then you get up in the middle of the night and you do your prayers of apology
wake
and atonement.
Up.
You wake up to pray.
Wake up in terms, not just physically, but wake up in
right.
terms
wake
of...
Wake up spiritually so that you're ready for the High Holy Days and High Holy Days, and you can have this experience of atonement. And you do it, it's really an astonishing experience.
Mm-hmm.
Every night through that
every
period.
Every night, 40 nights.
So... the thing about making tea and nice and mint tea and cookies, I don't remember that in my Slichot background at all. Is this just a Moroccan culture? Was it just your grandmother who did this?
I think both. Yeah.
In this period, as we prepare for Rosh Hashanah, are there other Moroccan customs as you begin to get ready for the new year? Do you start to bake early, or do you wait till right before Rosh Hashanah?
I don't remember too many specific. Yes, we have a very specific food for Rosh Hashanah, but not a lot of preparation like before Pesach. That for 40 days, you smell the economica. You know, all this cleaning.
All the cleaning for Passover.
Yeah, it's different.
So in a way, it's a spiritual. Slichot is really like Pesach in the sense, not in a physical cleaning of the house, but a kind of a spiritual cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
And you begin. We begin that. We're
nicely
in that period
said.
Now. Thank you. Maybe I should be a rabbi someday. Thanks, Oshrat.
Thank
we will
you,
talk
rabbi.
Next week.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Iran the last several weeks, and the fact that the regime, the Islamist regime, has been in power since the end of the 1970s. But there is change afoot, and there's certainly strong resistance within Iran. Let's discuss that a little bit.
Right. Well, I think the first thing to note is that the regime, while definitely extremist and fundamentalist and monolithic and not very democratic and not, in a conventional Western sense, terribly respectful of human rights, is not as extreme as the Taliban. They don't go around like cutting people's beards off or whatever.
Or body parts, for that matter.
Right. It's not quite as bad. And in some ways, one could argue, it's not even as fundamentalist as the Saudi regime, which is an ally and gets a lot of support, financial, political, military, etc., from the United States. So in some ways, it's not as extremist as it's often portrayed. That being said, there's a huge amount of opposition, especially among younger people, who want and often take great risks to have greater engagement with the West, with Western culture, music, movies, fashions, etc. I mean, shockingly, things like Victoria's Secret make their way into Iran, and people order the stuff in the mail, and it may be delivered to somebody in Dubai who then smuggles it into Iran. But a lot of women under their burqas are wearing shockingly Western risque garments, and men don't have to resort to such subterfuge. They can wear whatever they want. But there are lots of parties with drugs, sex, and rock and roll.
Men are wearing Victoria's Secret outfits too? Or
I have no idea. I haven't been there recently. In fact, I haven't been there since 1979. But I do know from people who have traveled there recently that there are lots of parties at which you could easily imagine that you were in New York once you actually get inside somebody's house, from what people are wearing, what they're drinking, the music they're listening to, whatever. They may have to keep the music a little bit quiet so that the neighbors don't hear. They have various ways of smuggling in alcohol, but they do all these things in violation of the most basic tenets of the regime. And it's not only like it used to be in the Soviet Union, that people violate the principles of the regime, they also increasingly actively voice opposition to the regime. There are radio stations, there are websites and blogs and whatever, which encourage democratic change. So I think that the regime, which has lasted surprisingly long, will not endure forever in its current state. I think it will soften, it will become more responsive, there will be a kind of perestroika, and the regime will eventually collapse the same way the Soviet regime collapsed. I have no idea when that will happen, but I do think that the what seems, at least implicitly, to be this administration's policy towards Iran of engagement and like more active exchange with the West rather than isolation will pay off in the long run. I think that's the way to encourage moderation and evolution.
We certainly hope there's evolution. And I can say the Iranians that I have met elsewhere, like traveling in Malaysia or other places, younger ones, very well educated, really want to go to graduate school in the United States. They admire Western values and they feel that repression. They may not be the majority, but they're certainly a significant minority, if not. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we return on Too Jewish, we'll get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set for May 29th to June 9th, 2016. If you're interested in going on this fantastic journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem in a unique and inside way, email tojewishradio18@gmail.com, tojewishradio18@gmail, or call 520-327-4501 for more information and itinerary information, too. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Howard and Becky are shopping for clothes for their upcoming cruise. As they pass the ladies' swimwear department, Becky says to Howard, "Darling, what do you think? It's been 10 years since I bought a swimsuit. I put on a little weight, but I need to buy something new for vacation. Do you think I should go for a bikini or an all-in-one?" "I think you should get a bikini," replies Howard. "I don't think you would get it all-in-one." Howard will be out of intensive care in just a few days. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Most of us who feel positively about religion believe strongly that nations should live at peace, that war will someday become an ancient bad memory. They shall beat swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall men learn war any more, our prophet Isaiah prophesied. But Isaiah predicted this great time of peace 2,700 years ago, and it still seems as far away as ever. The historical truth of human civilization is that war is almost always going on somewhere, sometimes everywhere in the world, and that the number of years in which this planet has been free of war has been very few. One calculation says that of the 3,400 years of recorded human history, only 250 have been free of a documented war. That is, once every 15 years or so, we actually have a year without a war. To be honest, that seems wildly optimistic. In my lifetime, I cannot recall a single year in which warfare has not been waged somewhere on the globe. Which makes the agenda of the opening section of our portion this week, Ki Tetzeh, sadly and strangely appropriate at any time. For it does not begin Im Tetzeh LaMilchama, if you go out to war against your enemy, but Ki Tetzeh LaMilchama, when you go out to war against your enemy. Pragmatically, the Torah treats war as a tragic but inevitable result of human conflict. We hate war. We seek to avoid war at all costs. We know that war is destructive to much of what we believe in and pray for, but we also know that there simply are times when it cannot be avoided, when in our fallible human ways we will fall into war. Perhaps the best translation of Ki Tetzeh is when you have to go out to war. There is an old platitude, all's fair in love and war. But Ki Tetzeh informs us that all is not fair in war, that we need to restrain ourselves both in our military conduct and in the ways in which we re-enter society. That restraint is essential to our moral claim to serve God through our actions, to fight for the right. We are obligated to act in ways that sustain and reinforce holiness, even under the exigencies of military necessity. And so the Torah scrupulously outlines the ways we must restrain ourselves when forced to engage in warfare. We are not to destroy the productive capacity of the land of our enemies. We are not to exploit captives, women especially, as though they were subhuman. We are to have a cleansing process after battle before re-engaging in civilian society. The contemporary Israeli army, the IDF, has its own code of conduct, the Tohorat Neshek, purity of arms. It's a serious effort to interpret the concept of fighting only the right way in practical terms. And when Israeli soldiers fail that test, they are held accountable by their own society. Perhaps the greatest lesson for those of us fortunate enough not to be engaged in military conflict is that if rules can be applied to the harshest forms of human interaction, warfare, they can certainly be applied to the lesser friction and human interactions that we experience in our own lives. If our ancestors managed to avoid the worst excesses of warfare, we too can learn to avoid the worst excesses of conflict that our own society presents. And then, free of these, we can resume our task to create a world of holiness and blessing in which, someday, Isaiah's words can really come true. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, the unconventional rabbi Niles Goldstein, will explore what he sees for American Judaism in the next 20 years, where we might turn for inspiration within our remarkable tradition. Find out when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, we marked a sobering anniversary, 100 years exactly since the lynching of Leo Frank in Georgia. The Leo Frank case is by far the most famous incident of persecution of a Jew in American history. The facts are that Leo Frank, a trained engineer raised in Brooklyn who had a degree from Cornell, was the Jewish superintendent of a pencil factory in Atlanta. Mary Fagan, a 13-year-old assembly worker, was murdered in the factory basement. The investigation was badly botched by the Atlanta police, who, in spite of evidence that a night watchman murdered her, settled on Frank as the best suspect. Evidence was lost, tampered with, destroyed, and withheld. Under pressure to find and convict a murderer, the authorities in Georgia settled on the unpopular Jewish boss. After a showy trial with the prime evidence against him, the perjured testimony of the likely real murderer, a night watchman, Leo Frank was convicted and sentenced to death. Through the open courthouse windows, the jury could hear a Georgia mob outside chanting, "Kill the Jew." The case was appealed up to the Supreme Court, first of Georgia and then the United States, but neither would intercede, although dissenting opinions of both decisions declared this was a kind of judicial lynching in an atmosphere of profound anti-Semitism and intimidation. In a final courageous act, the retiring governor of Georgia, John Slayton, reviewed the evidence, and on the day before Frank was supposed to hang, he commuted his sentence to life imprisonment. He said, "I cannot stand the constant companionship of an accusing conscience, which will remind me that I, as governor of Georgia, failed to do what I thought to be right. Feeling as I do about this case, I would be a murderer if I allowed this man to hang. It may mean that I must live in obscurity for the rest of my days, but I would rather be plowing in a field for the rest of my life than to feel that I had that blood on my hands." Slayton had been a popular governor, but after the Frank decision, he had to be protected by the Georgia National Guard, and he and his wife left the state immediately after his term ended, just 5 days later, never to return to Georgia. In August of 1915, a century ago last week, a mob, incited by former U.S. Congressman Tom Watson and led by many prominent Georgians, including a former governor of Georgia, two former Superior Court justices, several ex-sheriffs, and at least one preacher, kidnapped Leo Frank from prison, drove him to Mary Fagan's hometown of Marietta, brutalized him, hung him to death, vandalized his corpse, and took souvenir photographs and pieces of his clothing. There was one very important result of the lynching of Leo Frank, the last recorded lynching of a Jew in America, although not the first. Frank had been the president of the Atlanta chapter of B'nai B'rith, and in the wake of his unjust conviction, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, was founded. It has worked hard and successfully to counteract anti-Semitism and other forms of religious and racial persecution and bigotry in America for almost a century now. On this 100th anniversary of Frank's murder by lynching, may we dedicate ourselves anew to the social contract that America needs to maintain with all citizens to become a society in which prejudice based on race, creed, and color can no longer be accepted, in which the rule of a just law exists for all.
It's time for a champion, shoot the soul of the land, spend the heart from the sea and sand, till the sun comes up again. Time for a champion, shoot the soul of the land, spend the heart from the sea and sand, till the sun comes up again. Peace for the sky, keep your eye on the prize, forever in my mind, be my golden sunshine.
Last week, American reggae singer Matis Yahu, who is Jewish, was booted from Spain's Rototom Sunsplash Music Festival. According to the festival's organizers, they canceled his performance because Matis Yahu refused to issue a statement endorsing a Palestinian state. That's exactly as outrageous as it sounds. The implication is that all Jews are a suspect class. All Jews are responsible for the actions of Israel, even if they are apolitical Americans who promote love, peace, and understanding, like Matis Yahu, a past guest of Too Jewish, and that it's okay to demand that Jews prove they have the right loyalties and beliefs. But this is about much more than one Spanish reggae festival. This is about the big fight over the growing international BDS campaign to boycott Israel and the extremist positions many of its people take. Matis Yahu was scheduled for the main stage of Rototom Sunsplash on August 22nd, last day of the festival. His prominent billing made sense. Matis Yahu has been among the world's most famous reggae artists for a decade. His music has always been pretty heavily Jewish-inflected, which was a selling point in Rototom's official bio. Sometime after the announcement of his appearance, the anti-Matis Yahu campaign began. It was spearheaded by a local chapter of the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement in Valencia, Spain. BDS promotes boycotting Israeli goods and sanctions on Israel in an attempt to delegitimize the only Jewish nation on the planet. The BDS chapter wanted Rototom Sunsplash to cancel Matis Yahu's concert. Their big complaint was that Matis Yahu is a Zionist who defends a state, Israel, that practices apartheid and ethnic cleansing, their words. For a bit, Rototom's organizers stood by Matis Yahu. They wrote August 11th in a Facebook post that his previous comments suggesting sympathy for Israel didn't mean he supported all Israeli policies. But 2 days later, the head of the festival, Filippo Giunta, demanded that the artist clarify his stance on Israel-Palestine. Matis Yahu refused. August 15th, Rototom's organizers announced that the concert was canceled, citing the artist's failure to declare himself regarding the war, and in particular the right of the Palestinian people to have their own state. That's when the controversy exploded and stopped being just about Matis Yahu. Look, Matis Yahu is definitely not an outspoken champion of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. In fact, he goes to great lengths to avoid discussing politics, particularly Israel and Palestine. The fact that this alone got him kicked out of a Spanish music festival is horrifying. A reporter asked him if he was a militant Zionist, and Matis Yahu responded, "No, what does that even mean? That's getting into bigger questions. I'm not going to do that. I'm a musician. My whole purpose is to bring people together. It's not about focusing on negative stuff." Matis Yahu has at times suggested a vague sympathy for Israel, but it's clear his overwhelming view is that he is apolitical, and it's not his business to weigh in on such questions. Yet, the BDS campaign against Matis Yahu claims he supports apartheid and ethnic cleansing. Given the absence of evidence, the BDS chapter in Spain decided this based because Matis Yahu is Jewish, an assumption that Jews must support all Israeli policies unless they prove otherwise. The hostility to Matis Yahu reflects a belief within BDS that any support for Israel or Israelis is complicity in all Israeli actions. That is an odd standard, given that many Americans oppose U.S. policies like drone assassinations or wars in Iraq or Afghanistan without opposing the existence of the U.S. That standard shows that it's not just Israeli policies BDS opposes, but the existence of Israel. And that is a sad and truly anti-Semitic fact. It's why the BDS movement should be better known for its attack on this apolitical Jewish American singer than for any effort to search for justice for Palestinians. The festival later recanted, or re-recanted, and invited Matisyahu back, but boy, what a terrible taste this leaves. This is the true face of BDS, anti-Semites censoring peace and love singers because they're Jews. Ugly. Maybe as Matisyahu sings, one day this will just end.
I know someday.
You know, when Matisyahu was here on Too Jewish, when I joined him to Davin Mariv before a concert of his here in Tucson, Arizona, it was clear he was focused on spreading peace. That alone should demonstrate the idiocy of the BDS movement and its blackballing of Matisyahu simply because he's a Jew. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Niles Goldstein, one of, I would say, most interesting rabbis in America. I don't know if there's an award for that or if there's a forward most interesting rabbis, but there should be. His new book is called 8 Questions of Faith, Biblical Challenges That Guide and Ground Our Lives. He's explored spirituality and kind of the active edge of Judaism in many interesting ways. Nas, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, this book in particular hit on a couple of ideas that I've been playing around with for a few years. One is the idea of questions. You know, I had always been struck by the fact that the Bible contains so many questions. You know, the stereotype of Scripture is that it's filled with nothing but commandments, rules, and regulations. And in fact, when you look at it deeply, it's filled with a lot of questions as well. Questions asked by God, questions asked by prophets, questions asked by kings, saints, and sinners. And I've always been interested in those questions. So I thought it might be interesting as my 10th book, because I've covered a lot of other themes as well, to look at 8 of those questions in the Hebrew Bible and try to pick the questions that I thought were representative of the human journey from cradle to grave. I should say that interwoven with reflections on these questions and the themes that they highlight are also personal vignettes about my own journey through midlife. And that was something else that was very important to me. In a lot of my books, probably most, I incorporate stories and experiences from my own life to better illustrate, you know, some of the ideas and concepts of the books. And I tried to do the same thing here. And, you know, midlife has been a very rocky journey for me. And I know it has been for a lot of people.
Sure.
I think Jung says midlife, and said this many years ago, starts at 35 and ends at 50. but I think today a lot of people well beyond 50 would still consider themselves middle age. So it's been a very challenging journey for me, and I wanted to write about that as well and try to make some sense of it for me and for people who are going to read the book.
What were your favorite questions? You don't have just one, so what were the questions that you liked writing about the most?
Well, you know, the book ends with a question about the afterlife. The book ends with a question by Job from the book of Job, where he says, if a man dies, will he live again? The afterlife, the idea of there being a world beyond this one has always intrigued me. It's something that is very much part of the Jewish tradition. So, you know, I end the book with a reflection on the notion of an afterlife and that question. I start the book with a question from the prophet Jeremiah. Why did I ever issue forth from the womb? A kind of almost suicidal question by a prophet who really struggled with the mantle of his prophetic leadership. You know, he was someone who didn't want to be a prophet. he was excoriated by his community for being a prophet. And by the end of his soul searching and agony, he basically says, you know, why was I even born? So that chapter is based on that question, and that looks at the notion of mortality. You know, how do we live our lives knowing full well that they're going to come to an end? And we're never going to know when that day is going to come. So I kind of bookend the book with an exploration of mortality. I end the book with an exploration of the afterlife. And in the middle are questions, some famous, some infamous. For example, chapter 3 is the question from Cain to God, where he says, am I my brother's keeper? That chapter looks at the concept of responsibility. Another question from chapter 5 is asked actually by God, where God says to Adam and Eve, what is this you have done, after they eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? And that chapter looks at the idea of forbidden knowledge and whether or not there's some things we should just leave alone and not try to understand. So I pick 8 questions that I think are pretty representative, and those are 4 of them.
You know, I love teaching this one class I do from time to time, my synagogue, on life after death and Jewish belief, because I always figure nobody can tell me I'm wrong and prove it. You know, the answerables in a lot of these areas are really the challenges. We always say in Judaism, the questions are the most important thing. Do you feel like so many of us in midlife that, you know, you look around and you say, how did I get here and where am I going now? I didn't mean it to be exactly like this. In answering that question, do you think the Bible, the Tanakh, has something different to offer us than contemporary wisdom?
Well, that's a great question, Sam. I'm not sure. I think, and I try to spell this out in the introduction and the conclusion of the book. The book I wrote is certainly not, and it's based on the Bible. It's not really a manual. It's not really a self-help book in the conventional, you know, Western sense. It's really a guidebook. And I think that the Bible does offer us signposts to help guide us and to help ground us. You know, that's the subtitle of my book. But other than offering us some grounding and some guidance, it never, to my mind, offers clear black and white direction. And I say that as a Reform rabbi, as a liberal Jew. You know, I don't read it in a literal, fundamental way. So, you know, I think in that sense, my book and the Bible itself is really meant to offer us a sense that we're not alone, that many people, Jeremiah, Abraham, Job, even God, you know, many of us have been asking the same questions since time immemorial. And for me, that offers a strange sense of fellowship and comfort. You know, just to know that I, as a middle-aged man, you know, in 2015, have been asking the same questions and feeling the same sense of perplexity and bewilderment that others have since antiquity, you know, that does offer me some degree of comfort. And if my book can do the same thing with readers, then I think it was a worthy task.
So I want to backtrack to some questions about your career. You've started a synagogue. You've worked in synagogues. You've written a book about Gonzo Judaism. What do you think of the current state of contemporary Judaism? You really had broad experience kind of on the edge and in the middle. If I can be too broad in my question, are we working in institutions that are likely to kind of tail off, to not answer these kinds of questions? Where do you see things going?
Well, that's another good question. And you know, I wrote Gonzo Judaism in 2006, 2007. Many of the, and I looked at it again recently, and many of the things I said then, scary, it's almost 10 years ago, I still feel now, although I do think there are some positive developments. I'm not optimistic. You know, I will be frank with you as well. I'm not optimistic about the survival of some of our traditional Jewish institutions. The synagogue, as it stands, even though there are a lot of people like yourself, you know, working very hard in the trenches and trying to rethink and reshape them, JCCs, Jewish community centers, philanthropic models like Jewish federations, you know, I'm not tremendously optimistic about the survival of a lot of the Jewish institutions that we've inherited from our parents and grandparents' generations. But on the positive front, I see a lot of really interesting grassroots initiatives that are popping up all over the country that try to create a much bigger tent for people, especially younger Jews, to find a place to hang their hat in terms of Jewish identity in ways that I think were unheard of in the past. People are using nature, they're using music, they're using the arts, they're using social justice, social service to try to, using a Jewish framework to try to get people excited about their Jewish identities, to help them see that Judaism is actually relevant to their lives, you know, lived out in the here and now. And I think they're doing that in ways that traditional institutions like the synagogue, like the Federation, like the Jewish Community Center, just aren't really doing as effectively. So I'm not optimistic about the survival of our institutions, but I am reasonably optimistic about the survival of the Jewish community. I just think it's going to look very, very different in 20, 30, 50 years from the way it looks now. Honestly, I don't know if we'll be around to see it, but who knows?
You know, first of all, who knows? Second of all, you know, Isaiah said, Lo Navi Velo Ben Navi, I'm not a prophet, I'm not the son of a prophet. If Isaiah can say that, Allah kama v'chama, how much more so for the rest of us? But still, we work in this area. This exploration of midlife and questions is something that I think goes on for a long time. You were right when you said that, you know, if midlife ended at 50, it doesn't anymore. I see people in their 70s still sort of going through that process. What do you see next for yourself?
Well, I'm not sure. Without revealing too much, I'm in serious discussions with a Jewish organization outside of Chicago, and if that comes through, I'll probably return to work in the Jewish organizational world. If not, I've been thinking long and hard over the last couple of years of returning to the congregational context. You know, I have worked, as you said, in congregations for, 13, 14 out of my 20 years as a rabbi, and there are many aspects of that world that I miss. There are a lot that I don't. But, that is something I think about almost every day. You know, should I return to the world of congregations and take another synagogue? So I'm not sure what happens next, but I think it'll be something in the Jewish community. And I hope it'll be something meaningful where I can, really have a lot of impact. I feel like in my 30s and early 40s and into my mid-40s, I really realized some of my great goals, publishing a lot of books, trying to exercise some thought leadership, lecturing at different synagogues around the country. But my needs and desires have changed now, and I would really like to have a lot of impact. And if that means working with one specific community, I'm open to that. So I'm really not sure what will happen next.
It often feels to me like the ways we create community are slightly false. Is that an essential quality in a community, that we accept some things we don't really mean to accept just in order to stay in that situation?
I think probably. I mean, I think when I was younger, I was less patient with that. I was less tolerant with that, even in my own community. I think now I've become more accepting of the flaws and imperfections in myself. And I think that means I've probably become more accepting and patient with flaws or imperfections in any community I might serve. But I think you're right. I think the whole notion of community probably requires some sense of compromise and sacrifice. I think, when you're so ideologically rigid, when you're looking for purity in such an extreme way, you're really courting disaster. That approach is common in groups like ISIS, demagogic kinds of groups. I think the idea of institutional or ideological purity is something that probably is almost impossible in more open and inclusive communities.
I want to thank Niles Goldstein for a great visit. His book is called Eight Questions. His new book is Eight Questions of Faith, Biblical Challenges That Guide and Ground Our Lives. And I encourage you to look up all of his books, which are, of course, on Amazon. Where else can people go to find out more about your current work?
I have a website that is horribly out of date, but they could look at it. It's my name, NilesGoldstein.com. But I would say the best thing to do is go to Amazon and plug in my name, and it'll list all the books I've written. And I would say that's probably a better way to get an idea of the kind of things I've been thinking about and writing about over the years.
And they remain some of the most interesting pieces in the Jewish marketplace of ideas today. Niles, thanks so much for your visit today.
Thank you, Sam. I really appreciate it. Good luck with your work.
Thank you. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here on Two Jewish This Morning with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Israeli history professor Yuval Noah Harari, author of the stunning new book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. Our playout this morning comes from the band singer of the Sun Splash Festival in Spain, Matis Yahu, and his classic reggae song, Jerusalem. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.